Musangungwana. So I don't know what Ngungwana means, but it's been passed down. I guess they stopped doing that ages ago. Yeah, it's part of a clan. I think it's the third clan between the union that was formulated between the Zulus and the San people, what you would call the Bushmen. And it's the third clan. So they say it's Tatu, the third clan that came from that union. But Ngungwana, I have no idea what that means.
So when you turned 30, 2014, you decided you wanted to write your memoir, your autobiography. What was the important story that you wanted to tell?
I'd always been writing. I felt that there were a lot of things that I needed to take off my chest. But apart from that, patrons, wherever I went, always asked me about South Africa, where you come from, whatnot. And then I realized perhaps I should write something down that is more structured. But it was not intended for big scale or anything, just to write. So I started writing because I'm like, I'm not a writer, I'm just a singer, I think. But I know how to write a bit because of schooling and how to research stuff. So I started writing. Then a friend of mine, Amanda Edelman, who worked at the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia as a marketing director then, said, I've got a background in writing, I'll be your ghost or shadow editor. So that's what he did. And then when we felt that the structure was sufficient now, then I started working with a professional editor. So I self-published that, but I'm such a finicky person when I look at my works. I don't like listening to my own, say, recordings of performances. I always find some things to pick apart. So when I looked at the memoirs, like for the time it was right, it felt fitting for people who wanted to know, but the writing itself, the story is indeed fact, but how it's written, I felt it was verbose and convoluted and too long-winded for my liking. And also the dialogues were in my native tongue, Xhosa, with English in parentheses, which was too much. And so now I've started, I'm done working on a new manuscript, which is going to be published now by a publisher, not self-published, Penguin Random House. Their division in South Africa is going to publish the book. So an editor is actually working on a new manuscript. They're going to give me the notes when I'm in London next month. Then I have to work on that for 3 weeks before we start the proofreading process. Then in February, we launch the book, which I'm excited about because there are a lot of students who want to know where I come from or who come from similar backgrounds such as I, who are interested on how I made it out, how I work, how I go about auditioning and so forth, because they're interested in maybe following a similar path.
What was the township like that you grew up in?
It's a ghetto, basically. In South Africa, they call them townships. But you know, when you come here and they talk about a township may be more like a small city or a small place in a city, but that it means ghetto. These were projects, basically, that were built outside of city centers so that in the days of the apartheid, you were the help, you know. You didn't live because it was segregated. You didn't live in the center cities, no. You lived outside where you had to have a pass, a day pass, to go into a city and to seek work. If you were not from the city, you didn't have work, you only had 3 days to meander around the city and get work. If you didn't have it, then you had to get out of the city, especially the big cities like Johannesburg, Port Elizabeth, Cape Town, and so forth. And so I came from that. I remember when I was growing up, especially after the United States put sanctions on South Africa, President Carter did that. And so no, the United States could no longer do any commerce with South Africa. It affected the economy. So General Motors, Chrysler, Volkswagen, all these companies pulled off. And I come from Port Elizabeth on the east coast of South Africa, where many people were dependent on the auto industry for employment, because most of them are not educated. That's another thing because of the education system. So the ghetto, especially Port Elizabeth, where I come from, unemployment rate was, for black people, over 70%. And that's a city that has over 1.2 million people. 70% of that was unemployed.
Well, it seems like no wonder people were so, yeah.
So that's where I come from. So then the levels of crime, deprivation, I dare say depravity to a certain extent. Those what people would get through when I feel they're so despondent, they drink a lot, all sorts of things. Things have improved a bit, but when I was growing up, it was tough. So that's the kind of background I come from. Also, The apartheid government had introduced what we call the Bantu Education Act of 1953. This act secluded education among the races. If you were black, you could not study in certain institutions, you couldn't study certain programs of study. You could not do engineering. If you wanted to be a doctor, you had to go to a black college. But even if you graduated from there, they didn't quite recognize it, so you couldn't work in certain hospitals. So that's the kind of education I came from. As a result, many people, for instance, my grandmother studied under the missionary education, which was better, but then the apartheid government dismantled that. So my mother comes from the Bantu education. Most of those people, like my mother, didn't even finish high school because the education was so bad. So when I started school, it was at the cusp of the new democracy. So my education was different because they were trying different things. But that's the kind of background I come from. The townships was full of music, though. The townships are full of music because of the missionary influence and the fact that you in South Africa, you have over 11 official languages and all these different cultures. We're a singing nation. Where the weddings we sing, if there's a funeral, there are songs for that. It's just that there are even songs that are gender specific, songs for women, boys, men, and whatnot, and songs for everyone. So I come from that background that influenced me to like start singing.
What's your mother like?
Well, she's a headstrong woman, but she doesn't quite understand my world. My grandmother, who passed away in 2008, didn't understand my world, but I think her levels of appreciation were more than my mother. It took my mother a while to come around, especially after I dropped out of engineering school to say I wanted to do music. The very music which they still regarded as a Eurocentric thing because black people weren't allowed to do. Now I'm of the generation that was allowed to do that, and I like drama and music. And so she doesn't quite understand my world. She appreciates what I do. She doesn't understand, though, that I travel a lot. Keeps on asking me when I'm getting married, when I'm going to see grandchildren and all that. I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea if the universe decides that may happen. She doesn't like that because she comes from a structure where people say at age 30, I get married. I'm 33. She's like, in 2 years' time, you'll be 35. You're too old if you're not even married by then, you know? So we clash heads because she doesn't understand my world.
Wow. So how did you get out?
Well, through a number of people. I remember when I dropped out of engineering school, 2004, I started hustling around. There was a friend of mine who, from my hometown, who was studying music at the then University of Port Elizabeth. They've got a different name for it now. And so he said, how about we start an opera ensemble, do some pieces. This was inspired by seeing a group from Pretoria called the Black Tie Ensemble. This group was founded by Mimi Kutse, who is one of the old school sopranos who used to sing in the 60s and 70s and 80s. She even sang in Vienna. But in South Africa during the apartheid, they supported opera houses. So it's like in Germany, you didn't need to go out because you had everything there. So when the new dispensation of the government came over and they dismantled everything, now opera houses couldn't benefit. So private funding was sought by them. So Mimi Kutse started this small group of singers who mostly black, educated, who were performing, who were doing scenes, program, and concerts, and getting paid for that, and getting patrons to pay for their salaries and all that. So when we saw a newspaper article of the group coming to Port Elizabeth to perform, and we saw a name, a local person, Monica Osthuizen, a local patron. So we called her up and said, we saw that you know these people, could we come and sing for you? So when we went to sing for her, she liked my voice and my friends. And then she linked us up with Mimi Kutse. That is after we did 3 concerts for her because she lived in a senior village, performed for them. We didn't charge them anything, but they gave us like voluntary some money. Went to Pretoria to audition for Black Ties. They liked my auditions, but they said to me, but you don't have any music education. You are green, if you like. So you don't know much about music. We think it would benefit you if you were to go to Cape Town, for instance, and study music there. So we applied, and I went to Cape Town 3 weeks later to audition because it was in December. And in South Africa, the new academic year starts in February until November. December is summer. So December, January, that summer time there. So I did that. Now I had to like raise money. So she talked to some people in a local newspaper who put an article about me needing some money, which I was apprehensive about. You know, I'm like, I may not have this money, but I don't want people in my business. Now everyone in the ghetto will see that I'm seeking money. There was a doctor who saw the call and just called me. Said, hey, I studied in Cape Town. I did pharmacy and then music and then medicine. I'll give you the bus ride. You need to go to Cape Town for an audition and all that. So I went there to audition. Then 2005, I started the University of Cape Town. When I finished there towards the end of my graduate studies, there was a coach, Kamal Khan. He's American from New York, who had now started taking over as the director of the opera school at the University of Cape Town. He said to me, have you considered where you want to go after the University of Cape Town to get like further training? I said, probably Guildhall School of Music or the Royal College of Music in London. Those are great schools. Like, yeah, I'm kind of biased about America. Have you considered America? I said, yeah, where? I mean, I know there's Indiana, but it's too big of a school. I want something where I can get attention. Not that Indiana will not give people attention, but it's a big school. You know, I'm like, it's a big school, it's a great program. That's what I know about. But I need a place where someone like me who comes from a smaller pond can just get attention. And I said, I feel that there'll be a lot of other talented students there. I'm not sure. I don't feel. Then there's Rice in Houston. I said, there's Juilliard. I said, but where would I go? And Juilliard is expensive. I don't think I have money for that. He says, have you considered Philadelphia, like Curtis and AVA? I'm like, what the hell are those? Like, the only thing I know about Philadelphia is Rocky, boxing, and the art museum and the statue. And then he said to me, they're actually good schools. There's even Temple. I said, no, I'm not feeling it. He said, okay, let's look at Curtis. I said, but they are too young at Curtis. He's like, what about the Academy of Vocal Arts? I've never heard of this school. He's like, well, AVA kids sing all over America and they win everything. In terms of competitions, maybe you ought to. There, it's a small school. They take 6 or 7 students a year. They have about 25 to 27 students throughout, and you fit in because you'll get to do roles if you can get in. So we made a video and sent it to AVA, which was strange because AVA, they don't accept people based on videos. You have to go and audition and go through all the rounds like everyone else, but they accepted me. So a performance of Yatra Rams in Cape Town, and then we made a special video. So that's how I came to the United States.
Who was the first person who said, you've got something really special? I mean, really special.
There was a friend of mine who was like nagging me in high school. We used to sing, I just sang in a choir then. Those of girls, I was like, there are girls in the choir. That's just why you talk to girls. I'm like, rugby, I don't like rugby. We fight all the time. I need to be in a place of civilized people. So he said, I think you'd want to meet our choir director, who happened to have been one of the first black people to graduate. No, he didn't graduate. To go and study music, opera at the University of Cape Town. That is when now the doors of education are open to everyone after 1994. So he studied there, and he has knowledge. I think if he listens to him, my friend is the first one who heard something that I didn't. I fooled around, I didn't care. So I said, hesitantly, I said, okay, I'm gonna go. So then they auditioned me. I didn't even know what auditioning was, but it just said, sing a cappella something in front of everyone. I'm like, no, let them go away. I'll sing for you alone. So I sang for everyone. And then he said, there's something. Then he made me watch a video. That's what changed my life. A 1978 production of Magic Flute. Willard White, now Sir Willard White, from Jamaican born but British citizen, was doing the role of the speaker. I'm like, black people do this? What's this style of music? They say, well, this is opera, drama, and music. The language is German. It sounded like Afrikaans to me, you know. I was like, ooh, Dutch or Afrikaans, whatever. They're like, this is German, it's a Germanic, it's German. I said, great, they're wearing costumes. Why are they doing that? I was like, I like this. But what interested me was like, there was a black dude doing a role. Because I was so green, I didn't even know that black people could do now, you know. I was like, yeah, they've been doing it for years. and I said, okay. Then I saw a second video again with Willard White. This time it was a 1993 video of Porgy and Bess. They had first recorded it in 1987 in Kleinborn Festival. Then they did a video adaptation for TV in 1993. So I saw this. I was like, what is that? That's a black opera. I'm like, oh my goodness, the way he sounded. He was acting with Ms. Cynthia Haymond as Bess. I'm like, I'm sold, I want to do that. Now you can understand, I said, I'm gonna do this. I'm 16, I'm in high school, but at home they expect that I'm gonna go and do medicine or engineering. So I go and do engineering, but my mind was bent on doing what I saw 5 years ago.
That's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
Well, Mona and I live in the city where William Warfield grew up, just a few streets away from our radio station. And he, went on tour.
Yeah, because he did even the recording with Leontyne Price.
Yes. Yeah. So we know his family and they still live in Rochester. And so that's a wonderful legacy for our city.
Yeah.
What do you love about playing Porgy?
Well, I was really apprehensive first about doing it because it's such a, it's a momentous role, it's like big. And I was like, many people would say, oh, just Porgy and Bess, that black opera. But the way, I mean, he's on stage all the time. I count, the only time he's not on stage when I count everything, it doesn't exceed 12 minutes.
So it's exhausting.
Of the 3 hours of singing, he's off stage only for 12 minutes. And I'm being generous when I say 12 minutes, I think it's less. So I was like, then there's a physicality about Porgy. I said, but the great thing about it is it's an acting role. So it gives you an edge where you see this person throughout changing or developing into a certain character or personality. So I said, that's a great challenge. But the music is beautiful too. It's tough because you've been singing for 3 hours and then suddenly at the end there's that trio, which I think Gershwin was possessed by Lucifer himself to write, because you've been singing for 3 hours and suddenly comes these high notes and whatnot. But if you can get through it, then it becomes like this satisfying experience.
You've written that Porgy is actually a spiritual character to you.
Think about it. When everyone else doesn't feel best or they don't like her, you know, they discard her. After Crown has killed Robbins, everyone shuts her down. But let's even get back before that. When Porgy comes in, he asks about Bess, will Bess be with Crown? And so, oh, listen to Porgy, I think he's soft on Crown. And then he starts scolding them. Don't make fun of him. You religious women and you goddamn men, you know, don't put her down. And everyone is surprised because they always look at that. Possibly Porgy has never spoken to Bess, but it's possible that Bess might have given Porgy some money because he's a beggar. Maybe she was nice to him. It's not in the story, but in opera, always you have to look at the background on what they do when you don't see them on stage to try and fill in the gaps on why is Porgy suddenly interested. And at first, I think it's not just being attracted to her, but he feels something for her, he feels sorry for her, because this is this beautiful woman, but trapped in this situation where she can't get out of, and everyone is ready to write her off, but he doesn't. And then you see, even during the funeral, he's not a preacher, but he just out of nowhere comes out and preaches and try to motivate them to give more money. He's compassionate, he's a spiritual person. When they play the craps game, everyone else does stuff. But Porgy, it's like a ritual, it's like a prayer. Oh, little stars, talks about the stars and whatnot. So, like an allegory of some sort. Porgy is different in that. It's also interesting as we're talking with Francesca, discussing certain things about Porgy. The duet, the first duet, we felt that before that, they may have been living together already, but before that, it had not been official. It feels like a proposal. So the way we're going to play the first duet, it was not like they've been intimate or anything, but it's a proposal. I know you've been living with me for a while now, but are we doing this? Are we in a relationship? Because Porgy certainly doesn't feel that Bess is his type. Nobody is Porgy's type because he's a beggar, he's a cripple and whatnot. Nevertheless, she says, well, I'm yours. And then, of course, the second duet, I love you. I love you, Porgy, gives the affirmation. So Pogi is a very interesting in that, you know, it's connected to the emotions and the spirituality of it all. Whereas everyone is so, Crown is carnal, but Pogi is more of a spiritual and emotional person. That is why Bess is so conflicted, because Crown makes her do things, but it's also carnal. And then Sporting Life, of course, it affects her mentally too, because he's a drug dealer, but Pogi gives her this safe haven, I feel.
You are playing an outcast, you know, both a black man and a cripple. What did that feel like, and what kind of conversations did you have with Francesca about how that was going to play out?
I didn't have to dig deeper for that, because I'm an outcast in most things. First and foremost, I'm the only foreigner in the cast. We may all be black, but I am not African American. Now, that may not be obvious, but I did feel that way. Not now, but before I even accepted the role. And even if we're doing whatever opera, I'm always this guy not from here. Even now when I go back home, I realize in my hometown, I'm more in love with the memories, the past, because most of my friends are not there. Some of them are dead, some are in prison, and those are there. Few of them are alcoholics. Maybe three have made it out to live in different places. So when I go home, it has changed. It's not what I remember. The dialects have changed, how people do things, it's changed. You may see some new buildings and whatnot, roadworks, things that are improving. But in terms of the culture and heritage, it's not something I identify with anymore. So home to me is go and see my mother for 3 days and then I'm gone. Even when I go to Cape Town, where I could identify more because of the culture and whatnot, but most of the people I studied with decided not to go for music. They don't like this idea. For them, going to Europe, they want to go to Europe for 2 weeks and then go back home, spend the money they got from Europe home. Living like a vagabond, moving around from city to city, that's not them. And so I've lost a lot of friends in the process. I have a few friends, I have a smaller circle of people, because I miss weddings, I miss important things, I miss birthdays. And girls are like, I can't, I can't, you'll be gone for 5 months, when will I see you? So I feel like an outcast all the time, and I'm like, I'm off the world, you know, I make my bed wherever. So for me to play Pogi, I didn't have to dig deeper, you know, in terms of rejections of people looking at him differently and all that. Of course, I'm not a cripple, but I identify with some of the things he's going through because I've been through them myself.
Did you have conversations backstage about the political climate in the United States and how what was happening in the news was kind of impacting your fellow cast members emotionally?
I don't watch news. It's so depressing.
Okay, good idea.
Yeah, we are aware, of course. Some they discuss that, but my philosophy is I don't discuss politics, I don't discuss religion. That's your own thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not naive or oblivious to what is going on. If ever there's a cause, people can march all they like, but I feel that marches have never changed anything. If you look into history, people have been marching in this country, but what has really changed? Things that actually impacted change, like the Montgomery bus boycott and all that, those are things that, because when you affect the finances and all that, then change. You know, and so I think if some people want to make changes, then you give money to a politician. For instance, I remember the Latino people had been crying out for all sorts of things being neglected. So what they did, formed the coalition of actors, Latino actors and celebrities, gave a certain amount of money to President Obama for his campaign. So when he gets to office, we gave you money, then he starts paying some attention to what they are. The same as LGBTQ, they did the same. Of course, some of those things are being reversed now because we've got a different administration, but money talks, it affects things. So I don't discuss politics, but I'm aware of the things. Francesca did try and talk a bit on how we can meander into the current situation, but we tried to focus on Pogi, on the idea of homeland and humanity. So we hardly discussed politics when we were rehearsing. People maybe in their private times might have done so.
What happens to Pogi when he leaves the stage to look for Beth in New York?
Well, I don't think Pogi gets there. For instance, in the book that the opera is based on, Pogi is not as invested in Beth as he is in the opera. But in the opera, of course, everything is subject to interpretation, but they leave you with the hope. It's sad, because first and foremost, he doesn't have money. How the hell is he going to get to New York with a gold card and a goat? I mean, here we do the crutches, but in the stories, give me my goat. The goat takes him with a card. It's 1,000 miles. He's never been outside of Catfish Row. How the hell is he going to do that? So it feels like religion, believing in a superpower when there is nothing to support that. But it's a hope. It's hope. The audience cries because they all wish him well, that we hope he maybe finds a train ride. But then when he gets to New York, how is he going to find it in New York? Because he's probably, sporting life leaves a high life. He says to her, someone with your looks deserves to be in a place like New York. Bess has been admired by everyone because of her looks, but she's never had to sell her body. But you can bet when she gets to New York, she'll have to do that. How the hell is Bogie going to find her? And even if he finds her, she'll probably be under the protection of a pimp or something. He probably dies. But the opera leaves you with the hope that we hope he gets there. It's naive, but it's hope.